The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, what happens when a city runs out of water?
South Africa's most popular tourist city is battling drought conditions.
Cape Town, which attracts about 2 million tourists a year, is facing its biggest water crisis ever.
What they're calling day zero may be less than 3 months away.
This year, Cape Town came dangerously close to having no water. As the summer remained defiantly dry, its reservoirs reduced to small pools. In the end, a mixture of awareness campaigns and the muscle of local heroes prevented calamity. But are other cities going to be less lucky at the 11th hour? All that, plus much more, coming up over the next 30 minutes here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Cape Town has been going through a headline-grabbing water crisis. It's seen record low rainfalls and in the past month came very close to having to turn off the taps to its residents. That day, when people would have had to queue to collect a modest water ration, became known as Day Zero. Luckily, a reduction in the city's water usage has seen Day Zero pushed back for now. But as Monocle reporter Gavin Fisher has been finding out, the future of the water supply remains far from certain.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cape Town International Airport. For your own safety, please remain...
For anyone not aware of the drought in Cape Town, arriving at the airport will soon change that. Amongst the normal billboards and adverts, a different kind of sign has popped up in the terminal buildings. They say things like, "Don't waste a drop," or "Please save water while there's still water to save." So how did South Africa's mother city get here?
The most immediate reason why we've got here is a climate change-related incident.
Dr. Kevin Winter is from the Future Water Institute at the University of Cape Town.
We've had below average rainfall for the last 3 years, and 2017 is the lowest we have on record. And so that's the immediate trigger. What will happen in 2018 and 2019 and beyond in the very short term is too difficult to predict at this stage.
Cape Town's rainy season comes in the winter months, June to August, and good rainfall still remains the city's main way out of the crisis. The delay in Day Zero is in large part down to stringent water restrictions, with residents now limited to 50 litres a day. The average per person is normally 5 times that amount, with a 5-minute shower using almost the entire allowance.
So, what's your name to start with?
My name's Samantha.
Chatting to people on the streets of the city centre, it's clear the restrictions are a challenge, but one the vast majority have become dedicated to meeting.
Very tough, especially with having younger kids at home. But we're getting there. We're using the grey water for the flushing of the toilets. But it's been hard, but we've been working through it.
I think once you've got into the routine of saving water, whether the water crisis will ever go away, we just continue in that vein.
So your whole kind of attitude to water itself has kind of changed?
It has changed, yeah.
For me, it might be a crisis, but I mean, there's people in Cape Town that don't even have water. So Day Zero might have been started six months ago for me. It's been Day Zero for plenty of people out there. So it has opened my eyes for sure.
Khayelitsha is one of those places that faced water supply problems long before the richer suburbs were forced to take short showers and not water their gardens. The sprawling township east of the city is home to over 400,000 people, many of whom live in informal shacks and have to walk to standpipes for their water supply.
Okay, if we chat out here.
I'm here to meet a local councillor helping the area through the drought.
My name is Bongile Ngani. I'm the ward councillor for Ward 99.
Places like Khayelitsha, poorer areas of Cape Town, have always had difficulty with water. What difference have these people seen?
They see some leakage of waters because the water was sometimes been number of hours been drop off just to manage it. Sometimes it's been cut off during the night time. But however, we managed our awareness campaign to be careful, each and every citizen, particularly here in Khayelitsha, and the mobilization also the city embark on through the media, through the social networks. They see the importance now we not playing with water.
Ward 99 stretches all the way to Monwabisi Beach, where the crash of waves and cries of children playing in the surf are drowned out by the noise from the construction of a new desalination plant that began in January.
And then I think this pipe, other one is taking the water from the sea to that, and then from there is get changed to be a drinking water.
The plant is costing around 200 million rand, or $17 million, and will provide 7 million litres of water a day to the township by the time it's online by the end of this month. But Councillor Tsani says this isn't enough.
This is more like dropping a seed because Khayelitsha is a very huge population and that won't be able to supply the entire Khayelitsha if it comes to push.
So does it feel like they didn't plan well enough?
Yeah, exactly. So I won quite a while ago. I don't know why they didn't prepare this in advance and why they only were kept up.
It's not as simple as just putting down a plant. There are a range of requirements that one has to obtain before construction can be initiated. My name is Councillor Xanthia Limburg. I'm the Mayoral Committee Member for Informal Settlements, Water, Waste and Energy at the City of Cape Town Municipality. We have tried to accelerate processes wherever possible. So the first desalination plants will be coming online from next week. So we've cut certain key components of our budget to accommodate and fund these augmentation schemes because it's not something that municipalities, from a financial point of view, are designed to do.
South Africa's central government has also been accused of being slow to react, only declaring the drought a national disaster last month, a necessary step to free up extra funds for the area. Infrastructure has been a big part of this financial cost, but the city's government has also had to fund a large information operation to raise awareness of the looming water shortage. Part of the local government's campaign has involved putting out statistics on water usage, even down to the household level. I'm currently in Cape Town's City Bowl area, and above a busy road, just behind me, stands a massive scrolling signboard indicating the current water levels in the dams, the daily rate of water usage, and the change since last week. But this sign is not the work of the city itself, but a tech company who has taken on the task.
When you first download the app,
Trevor Swart is a director at Cape Town-based design firm Orcs Studio. They reacted to the drought by first producing a smartphone app called TapOff, informing people of current water levels.
We also introduced the idea of submitting your monthly usage and claiming your spot on a suburb leaderboard.
The visualization of the data has recently started being placed on the electric signboards.
Technology is what the local government has not been leveraging because they're using PDFs. They've spun up websites where the information is not the same as on their water dashboard. Our outdoor media now contextualizes the ongoing water use of Capetonians in a way that is meaningful so that they can actually take action.
The TapOff project is just one example of how the drought has acted as a catalyst for new technology and business initiatives to enter the water sector. And while reducing water usage is a big part of this, it's also happening on the supply side as well.
So we're looking at a map of the Cape Peninsula.
Claire Pengelly is a water program manager at Green Cape, a non-profit who work to support the green economy.
And the stickers really identify where there is basement water. Basement water is water that has been collected underground in buildings such as parking garages, etc.
Extracting and reusing excess basement water is just one type of new supply Green Cape are helping to promote.
A lot of the work that we're doing at the moment is looking at rainwater harvesting. It's looking at groundwater desalination, and treated effluent is also a very important opportunity area for a number of different companies. So we're no longer talking to businesses about how are you going to operate without water if you don't have water for 2 weeks? So the focus has moved, you know, very much from how do I survive to how do I thrive within this water scarce region.
This change of mindset from crisis management to long-term planning is something which the whole area will have to do.
From 2040 onwards, we will be a more drought-prone region.
Again, Dr. Kevin Winter from the University of Cape Town.
So it's changed our thinking, and I think worldwide, this same situation that's happening to us could easily confront many different cities around the world. It is making us rethink the way we use water, the value that we place on water, and the ability to conserve it as well. And that's all the learning curve that we've experienced, particularly over the last year.
Maybe it's the fact that they're surrounded by the sea, but the looming drought crisis in Cape Town never seemed like it would actually happen. But while the taps have not yet been switched off, the impact has been felt by residents, by businesses and by government. The lesson is slowly being learnt, it seems. A complete change of mindset on water must be made. Cities across the globe should take heed, otherwise it might be a lesson that they're forced into learning the hard way. For Monocle, in Cape Town, I'm Gavin Fisher.
Think of Dublin's Temple Bar and you think of stag parties, hen do's and questionably priced pints of Guinness. But the tourist-filled area offers more than that. Walk down the cobbled street of Temple Lane South and you'll find a building with an exterior as vibrant as the surrounding atmosphere. Opened in 1994, the green building uses clean energy from solar to hydro to power its handsome offices and apartments. But 20 years on, how has the building stood the test of time? Monocle's Sarah Miles reports.
'94 was a pretty significant year for Ireland. Riverdance made its debut at the Eurovision. The Cranberries, no need to argue, was smashing charts everywhere. That's the one with Zombie on it. And the EU's Thermi project was helping to fund the future of eco-friendly architecture right in the middle of the capital's focal point of tourism and stag do's, Temple Bar. Sandwiched between Crow Street and Temple Lane South, the green building comprises design both conventional and unique. Think artist-crafted front doors as mad as a bag of spanners, probably with an actual bag of recycled spanners melted into the mix somehow, yet not garish enough to stand out from the colourful busker-filled streets upon which they sit. Inside is a very well-lit affair. A glazed roof allows light to shine down on the building's high-rise courtyard and minimalistic white walls garnished with plenty of plant life. It's a bit Jack and the Beanstalk, but if Jack were in his late 30s / early 40s, drank matcha lattes and knew the exchange rate on magic beans. Although it looks like a modernist haven, a lot of the design is inspired by the museum building at Trinity College Dublin. The semi-glazed atrium and external insulation system are nods to the plus 150-year-old piece of palazzo-style architecture. Combining older energy-saving techniques with more modern technology, the structure incorporates a range of solar panels as one of its many renewable energy-securing features. Particularly beneficial are the evacuated tube solar panels. They're the ones best used for those of us living in inconveniently cold climate areas, such as Ireland, who need to generate high-temperature water for showers, washing up, or even just washing your hands if you fancy a bit more of a luxurious experience. On heated water, the green building benefits from radiant energy. No, that isn't a suggestion that all the residents are flitting from one juice detox break to the next. It's to do with the high radiant surface area built into the premises. This means only very low temperature water need be pumped through the radiant heating system to achieve a fuzzy hug of heat in all its rooms. A very deep borehole is used for the groundwater / energy source. Water is drawn up and heat extracted, saving the environment and bank balances of everyone working or living within the environmentally friendly design oasis of masonry and concrete. So have the eco-friendly methods used in the green building way back in the mid-90s survived to modern day? It seems there's no need to travel to Dublin for a taste of emerald green urbanism. Although more could definitely be done, a lot of the techniques used are now mainstream in Ireland and many other countries. Insulation levels and glazing are now a passive house standard, with grants available for solar energy and heat pumps. Unfortunately, six-storey courtyards and commissioning artists to build your front door are yet to become popular, but here's to hoping.
That was a report by Sarah Miles. Next, we return to Cape Town's water crisis. The prospect that the city would become the first metropolis to turn off its taps was the key focus of a recent United Nations climate change conference held in Edmonton, Canada. How could such a major city run out of water, and what would this mean for water management in other cities around the world? Seth Schultz is the Director of Science and Innovation at C40 Cities, a think tank that is run and created by cities that are looking to combat climate change through urban innovation. Monocle's contributing editor Sheena Roster spoke with him at the inaugural Cities IPCC Cities and Climate Change Conference, and here is what he had to say.
I'm very heartened and very excited by what's happening here in Edmonton with this conference. IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this year is their 30-year anniversary. And it was born out of a process that began 30 years ago when national governments as part of the UN were starting to hear more and more about climate change. They needed some body to provide information, detailed science to them on about what was happening so that then the national government policymakers and negotiators could come to some conclusion about where the problem was and who needed to solve the problem. So that's been going on. And as a result, the IPCC has become one of the most rigorous and prestigious scientific bodies in the world. And they provide the information to national governments on climate change that allows this decision to happen. So as that would pertain to water, a lot of the research that happens might happen at a water basin level, might happen at a regional level. Part of what we're trying to do here is to stimulate the information, the data that's being generated by academic communities or by practitioners, for that matter, at a scale or a resolution with which cities can take action on. So as it pertains to water, I think infrastructure stuff is more clearly known and lots of that is done at the city scale. But as it turns out, information that's done on climatic models that might have to do with storm surge, flooding, drought, those aren't happening at a resolution that cities can really understand and or make policies or take actions off of. So part of this whole conference is to raise the awareness of that, raise the need that that information has to get downscaled. Now, the other thing that's really interesting around this whole topic of water is it's increasingly clear that the way we've been handling water doesn't work. We're not paying the true cost of water. Water's been cheap. So as a result of it, it's wasted. Since you don't have to pay for it, you don't really have to think about it. And at the same time, the number of demands that are being put on water supplies have increased. But what this is and why this conference is so important is that the role of cities and the importance of cities and the decisions that are happening in cities have now become very, very clear to national governments. And as a result, the national governments are now mandating and giving the IPCC a charge to begin building and amassing that same base of knowledge and data on cities that they did for national governments that led to the Paris Agreement in 2015, which is 196 countries agreeing to something. That doesn't happen very often. Now what we're seeing here this week is the recognition and the awareness that's happened that we need to begin doing this at the same scale for cities, which is really, really exciting.
One hot topic that we heard specifically here yesterday in the opening session was that Cape Town is looking like it's going to have to turn off the taps after 3 years of drought. What's happening there?
Yeah, that's really captured the imagination of the general public and the news. And some are saying, and I don't have stats to back that up or deny that, but they're saying this might be the first kind of major city in the world to run out of water in that capacity. I don't know if that's exactly true, because what I was telling you, how cities actually already move water around, if other cities are moving water around from great distances via aquifers or pipes, and if they didn't have that, they might have run out of water already. So it's a little oversimplification of the issue. And every issue in every city is very context specific. But it is true that Cape Town is running out of water. That is the case. And what's also interesting is Cape Town has done a number of things because they've seen this coming for a while. This didn't just come out of nowhere. They've been suffering a drought for a number of years. and have put in water rationing processes. They've put in different policies to help address this. In fact, they were doing such a good job at this that they won an award from C40 a year or two ago, literally, on their water conservation and adaptation processes because of everything that we're doing. Now, they did that out of necessity. And that's, I think, why some people don't realize or recognize cities aren't just being inventive and forward-looking because they've got all these visionary leaders. They've got pragmatic leaders. They do have visionary leaders, but what motivates cities is addressing problems that are happening today. And that's where cities become such a strong leader and champion in this climate change debate, because they're not debating it. They're already feeling the impacts, already having to deal with it and provide for the safety and the well-being of their citizens. So as a result of this, Cape Town has done all these innovative things because they've had a drought, which is also why they got recognized and won an award. Now, there was also some people saying, well, they must not have been doing a very good job if they're about to run out of water. That doesn't have a lot to do with it. The source of their water is gone. So you can ration that all day till the cows come home, but once you run out of water, you're out of water.
Will Cape Town be a really big eye-opener for people because it is such a major city globally, or will it be more ignored because it's in the global south?
No, it's an eye-opener. It's already happened. I mean, it hasn't left the media. It's in the media in every single part of the world. What tends to happen is it becomes a big deal and everybody focuses on it kind of like a fishbowl, what's going to happen. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in Cape Town, but it already has already raised the level of awareness, the point I made earlier about engaging with the national government. Infrastructure right now, rightfully so, is they're getting quite concerned and panicky about the situation. They're looking at desalinization, which can provide some of that water, but it's very energy intensive and it's very costly. So it's something you don't want to have to turn to, but at the same time, you do need to have a mechanism to provide water to your constituents, your citizens.
I have a question then about the water shortage in Brazil and Sao Paulo. I lived there when that was happening and it was bad. How can a country that has the world's largest freshwater supply run out of water in the most major city in the country?
Yeah, again, it's just because of a lack of planning and a lack of awareness. And in some capacity, once that awareness is there, the lack of the resources to appropriately address it. And let's also not just make this all about local government and what they can or can't do or what they do or don't know. This is also behavioral. It's how human beings interact and treat water. So if you've been in a position where you've had water, you've never had to think about water, and you've got a natural system that is moving water through the place where you live, when those systems stop working that you take for granted, you also have this cultural issue, this behavioral issue. So it's not just putting the mechanisms in place, it's also trying to raise awareness of the local citizens, helping them understand that this isn't a unlimited supply or resource, and that we have to treat water the same way we treat everything else we care about. One of the other interesting things that's happening around the world with water is, in our discussion so far, I've mentioned a few times the additional demands that are being put on water supplies. One of those is agricultural purposes. And as the population around the world grows, we need to produce more food to feed more people. So you mentioned, you know, Brazil where you live. Basically, the land use transformation in Brazil for changing what was jungle and forest in the Amazon to farming land and or to cattle, the production of beef, has dramatically changed the ecosystem. So how that massive ecological system uses water and transports water is being rewritten.
How are meetings like this helping highlight the 2030 sustainability goals, specifically in relation to water? How is it helping get forward planning on agendas for government?
The SDGs, it's a really holistic way of looking at what needs to happen in a linked systems holistic viewpoint. And it's really important, especially as it pertains to climate change, because in order for us as a race, as humanity, as society, there needs to be some pretty dramatic transformational shifts. And the good news is there are things and there are technologies and there is awareness that still looks like we might be able to transform that to hold the world to less than 2 degrees of increased temperature rise since pre-industrial levels. But doing that is going to change a lot of things. And the concern and why the SDGs and a conference like this are important is that you have a situation where already there is a growing gap in the inequity between the haves and the have-nots. And that's not even global south, global north. You look at the spread of wealth even in the U.S., and it's getting exacerbated. So in a transformational change, we need to make sure that it works for everyone. And that's what the SDGs are about. And in order to understand those linkages and those impacts with transforming systems of governance or infrastructure, we have to understand and generate more information at a quicker rate about the impacts associated with those issues. So how do we think about land use and transportation? A great one is the amount of people moving into cities around the world right now is about 1.5 million people a week on average, okay? And the majority of that urbanization is happening in the global south, and it's happening in an informal way. People are moving into cities in informal settlements, meaning there's no existing housing. They're putting up tents made of mud or rubble or recycled material. There's no infrastructure. There's no running water. There's no electricity. There's no sanitation. And this is where the majority of urbanization is occurring. So how do we deal with that? And how do we accomplish the goals that we need to in a way that is representative of all people?
That was Seth Schultz, the Director of Science and Innovation at C40's Cities, and he was speaking to Monocle's Sheena Rossiter. And we end today's show with a short comment. In the summer of 1976, the United Kingdom was scorched by drought. Temperatures stayed high, and the usual rainfall that scuppers a British summer vanished. Reservoirs emptied. People were told not to bathe, or at least share their soapy suds. Britain was not a showering nation in 1976. Lawns were also left to die, soon resembling giant pieces of brown toast. In many towns, standpipes were installed and people had to queue to fill bottles and bowls. The government passed a Drought Act and installed a Minister for Drought. Although Britain has suffered many dry summers since, 1976 is singed pink in the nation's history. And there are parallels to be drawn with Cape Town, and indeed all cities facing major shortages. Because it's amazing how you can actually persuade people to act for the common good and save resources. In 1976, British people stopped wasting water. There was a sense of social capital, the "we can do this together" attitude that breaks out in these moments. Even in supposedly tough, individualist cities, people, on the whole, wanted to help. And as in Cape Town, this averted an all-out breakdown of the system. And again, while people clearly would have preferred life drought-free, that summer was also a time of mostly good humour. And as a child then, a moment I look back on as an oddly fun and certainly ice cream-packed summer. Now, as cities plan how to cope with these tough moments, it's good to know that solutions can often be found by sharing information with your citizens and putting their collective goodwill to the test, and maybe buying the odd ice cream. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, and it was edited by David Stevens, and our thanks to Ben Ryland too. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here are Smoke City with Underwater Love. Thank you for listening, city lovers. David sent you more.